Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Wilshire Amell Theater. I'm the Apple Soup. My name is Gilbert Martinez. I'll be talking right now. Just a few housekeeping things. Let's make sure that all your cell phones are on silent or off so that they do not make any sound during the course of the program. Please make sure that you are not taking pictures during the course of the program. No pictures during the course of the program. We do have books available for sale if you want to purchase more of them. We have the audiobook as well. So that takes care of that. Make sure everybody gets their seats. Fantastic. All right. Our guest interviewer tonight is a correspondent for ESPN and ABC News. He is currently the interim editor-in-chief of Grantlands. He is also proudly ex-receptionist and switchboard operator of Rolling Stone. Please welcome Chris Conley.
It's great to have us all here tonight for this wonderful conversation. Let's get it going right away, shall we?
Yeah.
The author and one of the many subjects of unfaithful music and disappearing ink, please welcome Elvis Costello! I took an instant and irrational dislike to Los Angeles. This was a town where nobody seemed to walk. Not being able to drive, I spent the first few hours sulking in my room at the Tropicana Hotel. When I finally ventured out, I discovered the Tropicana's most famous resident, Tom Waits, reclining in a chair in the registration office with his hat pulled down over his eyes. Things were beginning to look up. All the best people slept here. Tom stirred, and we introduced ourselves, stood there shuffling from foot to foot, looking at our shoes. The few words that passed between us made him a friend whose call I would gladly take in the middle of the night, and whose ability to dance out of painted corners remains an inspiration. By the end of my stay, I felt a little easier about Hollywood and all the lies it told. Somebody had persuaded me that the Tropicana was the site of Sam Cooke's murder. Now, this is completely wrong. But this was years before such details could easily be verified by consulting your pocket oracle. So I lay awake at night for fear of ghosts, listening to the low moans from the next room, sirens in the distance, and what I convinced myself was, Cupid, thank you, boy. Coming out of the air conditioning unit. All I got under that night was a line. Somewhere in the distance I can hear Who Shot Sam, which referenced both this episode and a George Jones song of the same title. Our Hollywood debut was at the famous Whiskey A Go-Go on Sunset Strip, a venue that had been at the center of one scene and was now trying to make another. To say the least, the scene was curious. In Waits' memorable phrase, it was all Halloween orange and chimney red. And that was just the boys. Some young people had made spectacularly misguided moves to emulate the London and New York punk style in ghastly makeup and inline dresses. The crowd also contained a fair smattering of leather-skinned industry types in neatly pressed denim. By the second set, people had quit pretending to ignore us. But this was just when the place started to liven up. Some boorish English bloke forced himself to the centre of the crowd, his hands roaming uninvited over a girl who pressed up against the front of the stage. Ever the gallant, I smashed the bottle someone had left conveniently between my vocal monitors and made some kind of offer to her with the jagged end, but I never really saw myself following up. Mercifully, the lamp was hustled out of the premises before anybody's blood was spilled. I woke up the next day in a boudoir full of lace and ribbons with the scent of tuberose on the linens. A girl brought me a very pale coffee, the colour of her complexion, anything to steady my pale and trembling hands. I'd never been anyone's trophy before, but I suppose I'd served my purpose by leaving on her arm. Whatever happened after that, with nothing to write home about. A few lies and evasions later, she pushed me out of the door into the West Hollywood morning. I walked down to the International House of Pancakes for something more robust for breakfast, and then went to play pool and drink beer into the afternoon at Marty's Beanery. You had to make your own fun in those days.
Welcome back to L.A. That was different from the time, of course, you went to Hollywood High. I think some people out here actually had that Hollywood High show. This was your encounter with Neil Diamond.
Well, that's part of the story, and that's certainly true. But, Frank? From the microphone on this one. Yeah, you know.
Not quite as much fun.
Let's leave the story of Neil aside for a while, because you never know it might. Is not just about Los Angeles. I decided to write I guess it's a kind of memoir. I decided not to write a book that began "I Was the One."
Why did you want to resist the word chronology?
Because that's what Wikipedia is for. it's true. That's obviously. It feels almost as if that we have a sound effects man in the wing. It's like, I'm going to plug this because I feel this might be the heart of it. Because I figured that there had been other accounts and there had been several books with my face on them, and I figured if I was going to write one, put my name on it and spend a little time, that I'd want to think about the things that matter to me, the things that move me, and maybe go back and look at the way I heard music, how I first heard music, and maybe I came to understand it taught me. So instead of beginning with my first record, or, you know, the first hit, or any of these things, or any of these supposed accolades, I go back to sitting up in the balcony at the Hammersmith Ballet, a venue that you probably, perhaps only know, those of you who remember Joe Strummer's great song about that venue. That was my dad's factory when I was a kid. That was his workplace. When other dads came home from work, from the office, my dad went to work at the Hammersmith Ballet, he sang with the dance band. He would sing on the TV and on the radio. And I consequently heard music very differently, even just to my friends at school, because a lot of their parents said, you know, turn that music down, you listen to it in your bedroom, or I don't want to listen to that and turn the radio off when the favorite records came on. For me, my dad was bringing those same records home to learn them, so he could sing versions of them on the radio. The pop music was set up a little bit differently in England. We only had one radio station of note at the BBC. So that meant that everything that came into the hit parade had to be filtered through the BBC, which was a combination of bands. And that's the way I feel about the BBC today. They were random with the initials BBC, and everybody that wasn't actually called that were people they had hired to interpret the hits of the day no matter how inappropriate those ensembles were, because it was really a way of keeping musicians in work. It was a very noble thing they did. These agreements were struck between the Musicians Union and the Performing Rights Society to stop recorded music from putting musicians out of work. The effect of it was that it completely mangled our idea of rock and roll and a lot of pop music, because we heard a lot of music second or even third hand as a consequence. And that was my first kind of glimpse of the things that later, you know, moved me to pick up the guitar.
The image of you up in the balcony, you sipping soda or eating potato chips, very powerful image.
Well, I thought that, but particularly the potato chips, I thought those were. You've got to understand, you probably wouldn't imagine any dance hall opening in the afternoon for maybe 30 or 40 patrons at most. They used to have one of those revolving stages where the band would revolve into view to create a sense of drama. And the lights would still go down, but when you looked around, as I did from the perspective of the balcony, you would see just, say, a mother teaching her daughter to dance and lifting her onto her feet and showing her the steps of the quick step or the foxtrot. But, you know, ballroom dancing. And the band came on in their powder blue suits or the maroon band jackets. And they were a band on the model of the Glenn Miller Orchestra. They used to open up with the song In the Mood. So it would seem very unlikely that any of this music that was then taken over people's imagination in the early 60s would be the sort of stuff they would play. But the band leader was a canny guy. He picked up dance trends, and he just thought he could synthesize everything with the help of a very imaginative arranger. I guess he was pretty skilled. He managed to write arrangements of songs as unlikely as Substitute by The Who or like a Rolling Stone. I mean, those were the sort of things that my father had to learn.
And you give us so many different moments with yourself and with music and other people, but one of your greatest gifts in this book is to share with us so many stories of your father.
Well, see, my dad was this guy. He was a jazz trumpet player originally. That's a remark that I think really deserved that kind of sacrifice. This is my favorite thing that I found of his I guess you would call this scrapbook. Is this? Those of you who can't read this at the back, go and get your eyes tested. It says British Legion Hall, Park Road, Eastburg, and Hare tonight. At 7:30, Ross McManus and his quintet, direct from their success in London and Paris. So this is making things up. This making things up thing began with my father, because at the time that little notice was put in the local paper in Birkenhead, the little town opposite Liverpool across the Mersey, I don't believe he had ever played in Liverpool, much less London or Paris. My father was something of a fantasist. I mean, he could really play the trumpet very well, and he heard the great new music coming out of New York and other places, which was bebop. And he learned just, I guess, from hearing those records, and he absorbed music the same as I did. He could read music, but he preferred to do it by ear. And, you know, when he met my mother, he met her across the counter of a record shop.
Because she was working here.
Yeah, she had left school at 14, and the first job she got was one which required her to get an education in music. She had her own taste in music, only like any teenager. I don't think in 1943 they either had the word for teenager, nor the time to discuss it, because they were busy being bombed by the Germans. But, you know, nevertheless worked until they met in the late 40s, and she became known among the musicians as the girl that works in that shop that knows a bit about jazz, and that's how their relationship began. So again, records are central to my very being.
You were born for this. You were bred for this, generationally.
Steady on, that's a family show. So they went to London to seek their fortunes, as people want to do. And my dad quickly found that, you know, it was a small competitive world of modern jazz was not going to allow for another bebop player from Birkenhead. There'd been lots of it before, you know. And he discovered he had another talent, which was for singing. And that even took his glasses away to try and make him look handsome like this. That made idle attempt. And then when he stumbled off the stage one night because he couldn't see anything, I had to get him back to him. Through, you know, all of my career, I was reminded of our similarity. We actually don't look that alike, except for the glasses. These ones, these are my reading glasses.
What was his performance style like? I mean, if you were going to watch him, what would he look like?
Well, I mean, the singers used to stand with their hands cupped around the microphone like this. They weren't encouraged to move around. But in 1963, the Joe Osorpsky was invited to be on the Royal Command Performance, which was a very prestigious show. You know, you're playing for royalty when this really meant something. I think some of you may have seen this clip before, but it's a curio that comes from the year after this big show. I mean, the show was really an old variety style show. They had magicians and comedians and excerpts from the Royal Ballet and from West End shows, which would be the equivalent of Broadway shows. They would have singing stars of the day, even international singing stars like Marlene Dietrich was the big hit of that year, with her accompanist, Bert Bacharach, who was at that time just playing piano for her and writing half the hits in the hit parade. Seventh on the bill, and I can prove this because I have the bill here. This is the spectacular program from this. See how beautiful that is, because it was for royal people, so it was very kind of fancy. There they are, the One Direction of that year. Between Susan Moran, who brought us Bobby's Girl, and Dickie Henderson, a very, very notable singer and comic singer. And there, I think in the next page, is 12th on the bill. The Joe Walsh Orchestra featuring my father, further up the bill in the Beatles, you'll note. And he came out and sang his song after John Lennon had made his now quite famous remark that you can clap along or the rest of you can rattle your jewelry. And that, of course, was what made the headlines the next day. So I watched this show sort of like, as it was broadcast, and about a little while later, the Jealous Orchestra was asked to make a short film in which they commemorated this performance, a number of performances from that time, and this little short film was made.
I'm
Those of you who have ever seen the videos for I Can't Stand Up for Falling Down, or High Fidelity that were made in the 1980s, will know that I inherited my father's natural voice. Actually, we did try to make some videos around that time in which I tried to emulate my father's steps, and we were actually hired a choreographer. And when I got there, I realized I was mortified at the idea of actually moving the left foot after the right foot, or the right foot after the left foot. And I said, when you look at those groups, Smokey and the Miracles, it's the Miracles that do the steps. Smokey just stands there and sings. The Four Tops, Levi Stubbs just sings. The Four Tops do the movements. So I made the attractions kind of take the dance lessons while I work my way through a couple of bottles of wine. And the rest is dance history, of course.
I have to ask, did your father meet the Beatles on that occasion?
He did. I mean, I suppose now when I think about it, it must have been mortifying for him because he was all of 37. A totally different generation. I think among the members of this orchestra, and when you see these people twirling around, these were of course saxophone players and trombone players, and there was nothing for them to do on this particular performance. It was just with rhythm sections, so they had to hand these poor sods like güiros and maracas, and these three guys in the middle, I don't know how many takes they did in this, but they just go around and around. That's why they look as happy as they are. These were people that I almost thought of as uncles. You know, they were very familiar figures in my life. A few of them were from Liverpool, so there was a degree of local pride about the Beatles appearing. Up until then, most Northern English performers had been comedians, and everybody else kind of affected either to be kind of posh English or American. Suddenly there were these lads using local humor. So my dad perhaps didn't feel as embarrassed as going up and asking for their autograph on my behalf. And, you know, he was kind enough throughout his career in the 60s to always take my little book and get the people to sign it to me. And, I already felt like I had a secret messages from the Beatles because he would learn these advanced copies of their records, so it felt as if we were getting them. They were exactly the same as the ones we bought at the shop, but because they were rush releases, they felt like as if we had a special message from them, you know. But, he did. He went and got John Paul to, there's me as a footballer, look at that, isn't it great?
Liverpool fan,
yeah. Before the show, he went and he got like a whole sheet of paper with the four signatures on it, and I proceeded to cut it into convenient slices to put in my own. I think if you look, I think I've cut the E of the Beatles in the scissors. And there's John Paul that like nestling together there on the page.
It's kind of a jarring thing to see that you were making music so early on. You know, it upsets our sense of the time continuum. You had a demo tape by the November of 1972.
Yeah, but I mean, the music that I grew up with, all this music of the 1960s, it didn't seem possible I could ever play it. That seemed like when I was listening to All Heartbroken Over Some Girl when I was 13 or 14, listening to Bernadette, you know, by the Four Tops. I thought that was played by an orchestra. That's what it sounded so grand, and the whole emotion of it. I didn't think it was humans playing. I thought it was some supernatural people. So when the music in the early 70s, you know, you had a choice: listening in the dark with the headphones on to Pink Floyd, you know, which didn't appeal to me. I glazed over after like seeing him at a play, you know, it's like, or Joni Mitchell, and that was the kind of music that sort of. I didn't think well equally. I'd ever love anybody the way she described in those songs like On Blue, but the way she wrote, it was both personal and you could also understand it. It was a different way. It wasn't like the romantic lyrics of, you know, I Second That Emotion, or the romantic lyrics of, My Heart Stood Still, some song from Rodgers and Hart from the 1940s. It was an entirely other way to write, and the intimacy of all those records that came out of California, or came out of Topanga Canyon or Laurel Canyon in the early 70s, strangely enough, that was oddly attractive to us sitting in Liverpool in our housing estate. You know, I don't know why that should have been, maybe because it was completely unlike our surroundings. It, it had a magic, just as records generally conjure up a world you can't imagine, just as the Motown records had. They were a fantasy of romance, so the intensity of a record like Reach Out or Bernadette.
As you started to make music on your own, how much did that sort of music shape what it was that you were making before you went on to be able to record a record?
Well, I think when you start to write songs, you just imitate. You learn from trying to copy the people you admire most. I mean, an awful lot of people, you know, got the idea that they could write hugely elaborate lyrics like Bob Dylan. You realize that if you try to do that, there's really very few people that can do that and not sound ridiculous, you know, that have to know where to stop. I wrote some songs that I thought were okay. I had a singing partner in Liverpool, and we mostly sang other people's songs. We sang in bars and clubs and we sang, I think we've got a picture of it in a poetry night. I think it's particularly kind of, this is a picture a friend of mine took of me, like, that was sort of taken at school, you know. I'd taken my guitar and I'd learned how to play the song, fellas. And then, will you ever fucking shut up and stop playing? And then, you know, I think this is the picture with my pal. It's not come on, don't I?
It's a little shy.
It's a little shy, anyway. But, you know, you'll just have to take my word for it. But the people in this picture look absolutely thrilled. And, you know, we were just singing, and I suppose, you know, the songs that we were writing were pretty purple. You know, they were poetic in the way that I thought you had to write. And little by little, I got the language that actually says, oh, there it is, look, it took a long time to get here from 1971. and there we are surrounded. I think this woman here, I think she's the one, she was the mad one. The one sitting with the little shoes on. And this was like a poetry evening that we were allowed to play at. And Alan, my pal, he kept a ledger of all our gigs in his school book. And he wrote down every gig we ever did, every song we ever did, how much money. He was the money head of it. We would play at like Catholic girls' school called Mary Help the Christians, which was known locally in Liverpool as Mary Feed the Pigeons. And I think we got like nothing for playing there, you know, except the promise of something that wasn't given to us. And this is one of his little notebooks here, and this is actually a gig we did at Quarry Bank School, which was John Lennon's school. So I thought, oh, I'm going to go to John Lennon's school. And when I got there, it was like much nicer than my school. I thought, this is the kind of working class here. They have trees overhanging the school. It's not what I imagined at all. And we got paid all of £3 for the privilege of playing it.
When you look back at your music in this memoir, one of the songs that you credit as being a kind of turning point is Hoover Factory. That this was the introduction of a new way that I think you say was less ingratiating than the music you've done before.
Yeah, all the people that I was just trying to write, like, I mean, if you were to hear the song that I wrote, that I was singing in that picture that's there with the striped sweater on, it was like halfway a Neil Young song and halfway Lindisfarne from like Newcastle. And then the next song would be a little bit like John Prine, and the next song would be like this, and the next song, until it develops into something that you gradually realize is a style, or it's a language that you're using. And the language that I was using immediately prior to the songs for which I became first known, and I first put on a record, they were really about true things. They were about being on the edge of town where I lived, and not feeling like I had control of my life, and they were kind of had a romantic view that we, you know, we might kind of survive that circumstance, but it didn't have anger in it or discontent, all things that were supposedly very valuable to songs in 76. And they also didn't command the room, because I was tricked by records into thinking that the intimacy of the records I loved, they were made by people who were already commanding an audience. So of course, somebody could come out and sing in a hushed spotlight, and it would be like it is now, quiet. If you try to do that in a club and there's people smashing glasses, you just end up sort of feeling foolish. So I had to just speak up a little bit to make myself heard. And some of that was just sharpening the language, not necessarily singing louder. Hoover Factory is actually a very pretty tune. But it talks about, it's not a matter of life and death, but what is, it was sort of more fatalistic. And then obviously, I was writing the songs in my, you know, little apartment, or flat as we called it. And I was writing songs like Miracle Man and I'm Not Angry. But I'm singing them like this, like quietly with my acoustic guitar. I had the sound of the band in my head, but I didn't know what the band sounded like, because I didn't have a band anymore. The band had broken up. I said, I'm angry. It's like a little man in a box, you know. And but the sound, the furious sound of the band was in my head. So when I was gifted the opportunity to play with some musicians who actually played their instruments and could play more than one rendition of a song, it was a revelation. The people from Clover, who had come mistakenly to London to make their name at the moment when being able to play your instrument was totally out of fashion, they could play you five different ways of playing any song and show them. And one or two of them were the way it was supposed to go, and that was My Hair Is True, which was made while I was still working in an office. Yeah.
And this book is filled with descriptions like that of some of the most memorable music that you made and how it came together. A song like Allison, that people have, I'm sure, asked you about forever. You give us both the origin and the special qualities that John McPhee brought to it that made it, helped make it so memorable.
John made it into a record. That was the thing. There was very few of the performances on My Hair Is True that were really records. They were really just a picture of people playing in a room. And there was sort of accidental record making. They were snapshots of my sense of rhythm and their sense of rhythm colliding. And so there's some tension between me actually wanting to play the song a little faster and then laying back, which is about the start. And then, you know, I was faced with a dilemma. I mean, the song Allison was the second single that was put out by Stiff Records while I was still in the office. It was also the second of my singles to completely bomb. You know, it wasn't a hit. So I thought the game was up. I had one more try, and they said, we're going to put a third single out, we're going to put this record, this album out, with all these recordings we've assembled over the year 76 into 77. You've got to quit your job. And I had a family, so I said, okay, you've got to pay me the same money as I'm getting. I can't do it unless you can just pay me my debut. It was not very much money, but I wasn't prepared to put my family on the line. And then I said, well, we've got this drummer that we've persuaded another record company to fly back to England on the promise he's going to play in this guy's group. And he's going to be your drummer. And that's how I met Pete. And there's Pete there. He's there. It was the best 150 quid of anybody else's money we ever spent, you know. I mean, there's a lot of talk about the rock and roll swindle. That was one of the minor swindles of 1976, was to have United Artists pay for Pete to come back to England on the pretext he was going to play in Wilco Johnson's band. But when all the time, it was always imagined he would play in a group that didn't even have a name at that time. The other two guys, we got them by putting an advert in the newspaper. That's the way anybody forms a group, unless you grow up with people. And from then on, when we found Bruce Thomas and Steve Naive, and to find somebody of Steve's quality, what Bruce's quality, just from an advert in the newspaper.
What was Steve's background? He had an unusual background.
He came out of the Royal College of Music, and we basically ruined his education. Or, I suppose you might say, improved it in other ways, you know. But, you know, his parents, I'm sure, were horrified that they'd put all that into getting, raising him to play piano so beautifully, and he played the organ in school, and he studied, you know, counterpoint and orchestration, and he knew all these things. He was only 19. If he was 19, I think he was lying about his age when he joined.
Did he know a lot of music, a lot of pop music?
He claimed not to know anything except T-Rex and Alice Cooper. About the third record in, he came up to me out and he said, have you ever heard this record? It's by a group called The Beatles. It's called Hard Day's Night. And you could never really tell whether Steve was putting you on, because he didn't say very many words at all. Most of what we heard him say for the first 3 or 4 years of the band was, ooh. But he didn't need to speak or theorize about music. He played as well as him. Bruce, on the other hand, had played in groups. He'd been around America. He'd been in a couple of hippie groups in the 60s. So he was older than us, and he was more cynical in some ways. But he developed a very imaginative way to play the bass, which didn't involve playing the bass at all, really. It involved playing the cello, which was just what we wanted. For those records, he played melodies all the time. He occasionally hit the bass register, and it would open up a big great sound in the bass, but a lot of the time he was playing a counterpoint to the vocal melody, a lot of invention. So I just had to stand in the middle and sing with Pete behind me driving it. And I there was no reason for me to play any solos. I mean, I never wanted to be Eric Clapton or anybody like that. I never really played the thin ones, as they call them. I just played chords. And the rhythm section, in some senses of it, was the through line of the rhythm guitar and the drums, while the other guys just did whatever came into their heads. And of course, they played more conventional roles as well, but I think that's what marked those records out. And if you look at a group like The Who, you know, we were working in that tradition of like, what kind of group is that? You know, the drummer is playing soloing all the time. This guy that's standing over here, what is that? Is it a bass? Or is it like a Panzer division coming through? It's this huge sound, it's nothing to do with the bass. And a guy playing chords, you know, and occasionally playing solos, and a guy swinging a microphone around. It shouldn't work, but it did. And really, far more English music is based on chaos in a way, and we're inviting chaos, exciting kind of art noise. You know, that's really Pink Floyd, even when they were a good group. And, even Led Zeppelin, who I can't stand, but there's something thrilling about the sound. I get it now. Okay, it took me a long time. Yeah.
What did it feel like to be in front of it for the first few times? What went through you as you heard what they sounded like playing behind them?
Well, we were sent down to the farthest away from London as we could get. We were sent down to the little toe of England, Cornwall. And we were in an old RAF base that doubled as the village hall in this village we were rehearsing in. And we rehearsed for a week. We learned as many of the songs from My Hair Is True as seemed sensible, and half a dozen songs that I'd written since then, which became half of the next record. So we were half a record ahead of everybody else already. And then we went down to a place called Penzance. It's about as far as you can go. The next stop is sort of Charleston or somewhere. You know, it's like you just keep going, you'll end up in America. And that was our intention. We were opening up for Wayne County in the Electric Chairs. It was before Wayne became Jane, so it was like, and they're kind of, you could summarize their sort of attitude to us and pretty much everybody else by their big hit, which was called Fuck Off, you know. And then it's like this large, irascible person in a dress, pitching up the skirt to piss in the sink in the corner of the dressing room. It was a glamorous introduction to show business. And we played to, you know, I think pretty much indifference, because we didn't really have any records at being on the charts. We didn't have, people didn't really know who we were, but we were sent out to try out, you know, to open out of town as these two in the musical. And then we came up to London to play our first show. And my manager said, before we do that show, we're going to go audition for Columbia Records so we can get this record out in America. And a couple of lightly lads came with big sort of placards that looked like a political demonstration. We stood outside the Hilton Hotel in Park Lane. They were marching up and down, chanting, "Come and see Elvis," and I was playing my little battery-powered amplifier and playing my songs, and the hotel panicked and thought it was a political demonstration and called the riot squad, you know. But they called the police, and what turned up were, would be now called the anti-terrorist squad. It was maybe about 15 policemen, and everybody except me ran away. And I was left there nose to nose with this very, very pissed off. It was an inspector, which was a senior rank. And we ended up doing a little dance like this, where I'm playing, you know, Miracle Man or something, and he's going, "Move along, Sonny, you're obstructing the footpath." So I would go, and he would come here and stand in front of me. So strictly speaking, he was really obstructing my footpath, you know. And then he'd say, "Don't do that again." And then he would come and stand in front of me and he said, "You do that one more time and you're nicked." And of course, it was too much temptation not to just go, "And that's it, you're nicked." And I got sort of walked off to the, as they call it, the Black Mariah. And as he pulled away, he said, "What is the matter with you people?" As if he was always arresting people outside of hotels by long time. "Why don't you people ever see sense?" Or his words that affect. And I said, "Well, I have a show tonight, you know. I've got to play a club. He said, not if we keep you in. I tried to put the fear of God on into me, and they got us to the police station and took away my shoelaces and my belt and my tie in case I hung myself for the shame of committing the publicity stunt. Eventually, I was sprung, and you know, we did the show nonetheless.
When you came to America, you talked about the kind of reaction you got. You said real enthusiasm mixed with skepticism and hostility. You got the feeling that people felt this is how they should act.
I think there was a bit of that, you know, there was a punk scene in New York, which really where Malcolm McLaren nicked a lot of the ideas. I think he'd seen the New York Dolls and he took that back and got some English version of that. There was scene going on here in Los Angeles, but none of it really linked up because there was no, you know what, there was no MTV then, there was no internet, so you could go from town to town and you could hear the regional accents of the music, and there were different records playing in Cleveland and Akron than were playing, you know, in Oklahoma, and certainly very different than the ones that were playing in England. So by the time we'd been around America a few times, we got the idea that it was a bigger task to conquer corruptible America, you know. We realized that it wasn't going to be quite so easy to go from place to place. So little by little, we got the idea of it, you know. Can I read you a little bit?
Yeah,
just,
please.
Just popped in my head. Oh, yeah, I love that sound. I can just declaim, like, you know, like the 19th century.
Sure, you know, like you were telling the story of the Battle of Gettysburg.
Yeah, something like that. It can't grow. Particularly funny when you hear this first line. If Carnal Scream could ever said to be ironic, then this was the sound that greeted the attractions in me as we took the stage of Hollywood High School in the spring of 1978. For all I knew, a gaggle of cynical Hollywood girls might have actually been enlisted by the management to act as extras in the drama. It was only later that I found out that Alan Arkush had been up in the balcony with a secreted Super 8 camera shooting trial footage for a movie that he would later make with the Ramones called Rock and Roll High School. The silent footage makes the clockwork movements of the players skittering on the stage seem all the more comical and ridiculous, given the supposedly riotous circumstances. But it was something of a stunt to bring our brittle and increasingly surly new wave pop to the high school hop at the head of the bill that included the rock and roll of Nick Lowe, and Dave Evans' Rock Pun, and the cartoon junky melodrama of Mink DeVille. Suddenly there was just a piano playing and girls calling out my name like they didn't mean it. A few days earlier, the attractions and I had been driving down Interstate 405 in a station wagon on our way to Long Beach. A record This Year's Girl came on the radio. Just as a convertible full of ideal-looking Californian girls overtook us, their blonde hair streaming in the breeze. We were hanging out of the window saying, "It's us! It's us!" Hugging drums and guitars. "We're on the radio!" We yelled, our voices swallowed by the rushing air. They looked alarmed. Perhaps we were a strange cult of innocent-faced kidnappers, or more likely they had this radio tuned to a disco station. It wasn't like back home where there were only a few choices. The girls quickly accelerated out of sight and out of earshot. There was only one other time that I can remember all of us being in the same place when our record came on the radio, and it was a little less glamorous. It was a dank, hungover afternoon before a gig at the local Top Rank a year or so later. Four pasty young men were in a Brighton cafe staring at a single plate of congealed eggs and pale red beans on a raft of toast for which none of us had any appetite. During an improbable lull in the business of the day, accidents will happen was breezily announced by the BBC. The disc jockey's mid-Atlantic prattle suddenly battling with the rising crackle of deep fat fryer until you want to drive a blunt knife bleeding with egg yolk through the speaker into his smarmy heart. "Turn it up!" we shouted to the man buttering toast behind the counter as the music began. "What, mate? The radio, turn it up, it's us!" Just then the coffee machine began squealing. "Turn it off, make sure it's bloody rubbish." It was that summer that Steve Naeem and I had debuted at the opening night at the Hollywood High School as girls beat time with lipstick and let out insincere squeals. The song had come to me as I was heading for the Mexican border in a taxi about a week earlier. My passport was in my pocket, and my cab driver was quite attractive. I'd taken a handful of white pills and wanted to see the sights outside of Tucson, Arizona. As ungallant as this may seem, I do not recall her name. But I remember that she lived in a house that had half in the number. The rest of the digits were in the thousands. Maybe it was only half a house. We had already done all that we were bound to do. It was hot, but only on the thermometer. Afterwards, she showered and put on another shirt. We went back to her cab. I hope she hadn't left the meter running, because we didn't have much cash left. Did we have enough left for a very early morning in Mexico? Perhaps not. We got to the edge of town and started to annoy each other, arguing about the radio. The heat had gone out of the night, so she turned the cab around and drove back to my motel. We said our curt goodbyes. Could I add a tip to the fare under the circumstance? Would it be an insult? The sun was nearly up. I hadn't found anything I was looking for, only an aching head and a dull, guilty regret. It was a Fender Palomino acoustic lying in the corner in an open case, which, as you know, symbolizes low morals and easy virtue in paintings of antiquity. It wasn't loud, so it was ideal for playing ear-torn within thin walls. Anyway, someone was moaning nearby, and there was a regular tattoo of a headboard against the plastic wall, and I thought, they get up early around here, or they never go to sleep. The song came quickly, a descending bass line and a rising melody. I had wanted to write something like the Bacharach and David song, Anyone Who Had a Heart, because it seemed to mark the absence of one, but I also lacked the skill. So I wrote what I could imagine. 30 minutes later, I had most of the lyrics and the chord changes that Steve and I would later illuminate on the recording. Just as it had begun the Hollywood High School show, accidents of what happened would eventually open the armed forces. That would be an entirely different scene in the song that opened with the line, I just don't know what to do, I just don't know where to begin. Accidents is a song about a straying lover, struggling to tell the truth and face the consequences. I changed every I to we so as to share the blame that was entirely my own. Then I changed I to he to further cover my tracks. This was pop music, not confession.
And this book is filled with stories like that and moments of introspection. And you dealing with the idea that people often wish to imagine that your songs are confessional, or that they are directly true, or that they are...
They're directly true, but not necessarily literal. When you write songs, you put things that happen to you, things you observe, into a scene, and you could transpose people that you've met, people you've known, things you've done, things you should have done. You know, crime writers kill people all the time, but they rarely go to jail. I learned that it didn't have to be a literal recitation. A literal, complete real-time telling of the breakdown of a love affair. It just has too many pauses. You couldn't make it musical. You have to compress everything. So occasionally you can get into rendering it more literally, like a song like I Want You, where it is 6 minutes long, because it's the picking up the hurt and the wound until it represents something. And when I wrote it, it was about something true, or something that perhaps has occurred. When you sing it again, you have to find a way. You don't just sit there going over the same argument. You have to then make it so that other people can see themselves in it.
You bring this up also with regard to the song Party Girl, that you don't without the same experience that generated the song every time you sing.
No, I don't think you can. So that's what I learned. And at different times, the clarity, the apparent clarity of lyrics is questionable, I would say, because I felt that you could write songs that were where the words conjured up a picture rather than described it in exact detail. Then other times I felt I want all of that musical accompaniment to fall further away over the songs on King of America, like In Your Fireworks. where the, it's very clear what's being said. They all have a reason to exist. And, you know, I have liked enough different songs by other people that I do have. There was just more than one way to tell a story, or skin a cat. Yeah.
How did you begin to consider your remarkable verbal facility and to, at least for a time, put it aside so that you could deal more directly with intention and emotion?
I think part of it was going to Nashville and recording Almost Blue, giving myself a pause from writing songs entirely and singing the way I felt using other people's words. And we had always sung other people's songs. I had recorded My Funny Valentine in 1978. One of the first songs we ever covered was I Just Don't Know What to Do With Myself, the Blackbird David song. Introduced songs that were sometimes a contrast to the music that we played. We used to play the Randy Crawford song, One Day I'll Fly Away. And I would find ways to derail shows in the mid-80s by playing like five R&B ballads back to back that I liked and everybody else hated. You know? because I didn't feel there was anything in what we were doing at that point. In the songs I'd written, we were up there to sing maybe four songs a night, as far as I was concerned.
I want to point out that this book really gives us a great look at the album Imperial Bedroom. Takes us really inside, which I think is a special record for a lot of people.
You talk about looking at that mind when I just need to see that yellow coat one more time.
you talk about the process of recording that record. You were down the hall from Paul McCartney, who was doing Tug of War.
I think he was doing Tug of War. I mean, those records, they all ran together. I mean, he was recording almost constantly. I don't know which records they came out. I mean, it was a little, it was the first time we'd ever been in a studio. I mean, you've got to bear in mind that the first couple of records were made in a very small studio, no other room, so we never saw other musicians except when we were on the television or ran into them at other festivals, you know, which we didn't play many of those. We played our own shows, we didn't open for anybody, so we were on, we had people that were on the bill with us, but we didn't much pay attention to that. So when we were suddenly in one of these more sophisticated studios and we set the task of making a record and giving ourselves 12 weeks to experiment, we found that, you know, Paul McCartney was in one studio, we were in the other, and Alice Cooper was in the room in the middle, or Duran Duran, or, you know, whoever was there that week, you know. And of course, you would meet them in the hall, and then you have to kind of develop a little bit of social skill, which I totally lack.
You talk about the way the lyric content in your music moved from being specific to dealing with, moved from being like individual to dealing with broader issues, I guess. Probably poorly phrased, but.
Well, I just described really that there were some songs on Imperial Bedroom that didn't make literal sense. They were, I suppose they took a cue from painting. They took a cue from painting that you could, there were paintings where there were more than one angle rendered on the same canvas. In fact, if it can work in a frame, it could work in a song. So that was an experiment which I, you know, took advantage of, and different voices, taking different parts. My own voice was using different tones and harmonizing it in different groups.
You were speaking on the microphone in a different way.
So I was using the microphone in a way that you couldn't if you'd just been singing inside a clock or, you know, very, very close with some really furious backing behind it, you know?
We heard Beyond Belief, I think, as you guys were coming in.
The record was made by Pete, really, because he came and played such a sensational drum part. I mean, I'm sure forgive me for saying that at the time, we were both trying to rid the world of alcohol by drinking it. And so, you know, he tumbled through the door in somewhat disarray, and I was impatient to get to work, and we had waited on him arriving, and I said, that's it, you've got one take, and then you go for a lie down, and he delivered that one take and transformed the recording of that record, because it was, I don't know, I had no idea where the idea for that type of playing came, but it was a sort of a version of this idea of soloing all the way through. Nothing is in its conventional place, and it made all the rest of us play differently. I mean, and of course then I had the opportunity to pretty much rewrite the song at the back. Over that head.
And you'd never done that before?
No, that's a style of recording that was very popular in the 80s, which we never really invested in. That's the big music, as people call it, you know, U2. Because they're, you know, close rivals at that time. People don't remember, but there was a time where the race for this new crown of music was between U2, Echo and the Bunnymen, Simple Minds. They all did versions of this open-ended music with great, huge vistas. We weren't about that. I was writing these Dixieland band songs that were just short, little, nervous little rhythm things, and they suddenly sound very old-fashioned. That's one of the reasons that we went to R&B rhythms on Get Happy, and it was one of the reasons we experimented with all these different forms. Because all that kind of nervous new wave shit, it was just like, it was tired. We'd had it with that.
Something like Man Out of Time, which is a song that I think still runs through people's minds on a weekly basis sometimes.
Well, that would be great if it did, but it's a song that was tried a couple of different ways, as they often were. That's what when you use the studio less as a place to capture a performance and more as a part of the instruments that you're playing. That's, you have to try a few different things, and sometimes you need a foundation on which to build. It's not the way I would have recorded up until that point.
What did life on the road become for you after that? Because there are a lot of lines in this book that are very, you're very hard on yourself in terms of what you felt you were becoming as you continued to tour and work incessantly.
Writing a book like this is an opportunity to look at the songs we've written and really what they were saying, as opposed to what they appeared to be saying. And some of the songs that I wrote when I was quite young, before I really was out in public that much, I found doubt in about myself that I kind of tried to scare those suspicions about myself away by singing them out loud. And it's not something glorious to relate, but the pain that I caused my first wife in the course of just following my own impulses, you can blame it on drinking too much or taking drugs or just simply being willful or having not worked out your desires. Any of those, they pick any one of those and it could be true. And I'm not about to revisit them all in detail. That's why I wrote about them in a kind of alluding to that rather than luridly telling the tale of all these affairs, because they're all human beings, and the people that I betrayed, and also the people who I suppose I cheated myself and them into thinking there was something more romantic to be seen in a chance meeting. I would ennoble it in song, and after a while I started to be very uneasy about the fact that I was starting to provoke misery just so I had material to write about. That's not very nice.
Is that really true?
I think it was definitely true for a little while. I won't name the songs because they might be your favorite tune, but I think if I were really honest with myself, I'd say yes, I did do that for a little while, and then I thought, well, that's false. That isn't really. That's doing it, and that's like I'm sure we all know people who just dwell on the gloomy side and they look for that all the time in every situation. I have seen under the note, I see the color blue, and I would lean into that. And alcohol can help you along with that quite pretty good, particularly gin.
I think you essentially say, I thought I was better than that, and I was mistaken.
I'm a good Catholic boy to begin with, but it didn't work out that way. They wanted me to be a priest.
They wanted you to be a priest?
Yeah, the nuns, they wanted me, Father Declan. Yeah. I would have made a good priest, actually. A good priest. Yeah. This is a thing.
You began to have the opportunity to meet and to collaborate with some of the artists that you had great affection for. Some of your most fondly remembered collaborations would have to be with Paul McCartney. What was that like for you initially as you...
Well, we become acquainted, we played on Wings' last ever show. So
at the Campuchia.
Yeah, so we invited us to be on that, and then we were in the studio. So it wasn't like he was a total stranger. I mean, it got over the fact that he was that guy that was on Hard Day's Night. It was like we'd heard all the records. We would tour around and America, and sometimes the only record that we'd find that was worth playing on a jukebox in somewhere in the middle of nowhere would be a Wings record. I liked a lot of their records. There was a lot of Wings ideas in armed forces, funny enough. I know from my point of view, some of the arrangement ideas were definitely lifted from them. So I was familiar with all of his music, of course, you know, and the Beatles intimately from 10 years old. And
so could you ever say to him what his music meant to you, or was that something that just couldn't articulate?
I mean, Gary heard it, and hasn't he suffered enough?
Yeah.
He just really need that, you know. I think if he was kind enough to ask me to come and write songs, it was to come as the adult that had written a few good tunes of his own. The point of it was to try and write something that he couldn't write on his own. And he had an unbelievable good fortune to have such a contrasting writing partner. When he was a young man, he'd worked, he'd formed several other bands. The only thing I thought curious was his music, after the Beatles, made no reference to the harmonic language of the Beatles, which is... In this, he really has only one precedent, and that would be Richard Rodgers, who completely changed his style of writing with a different lyricist. And I thought, well, in a world where ELO exists, you know, and are fantastic, by the way, their songs are wonderful, it seems crazy. And then, you know, obviously, long after Paul and I wrote those songs together, you know, we have to live in a world with the Gallagher brothers. In the Oasis, you know, throughout pop music, you've heard many people refer to the Beatles as a starting place. Why couldn't he do it if he wanted to? And so we wrote one or two songs that had those kind of cadences in them. And of course, it was pretty good fun, you know. I couldn't sing higher than him, so I'd end up singing below him. We wrote one song that was called You Wanna Too, which was a dialogue between an idealistic romantic guy and a cynical, you know, guy, and I'm singing every other line in the song, and about halfway through the playback, he turned it down and said, hold on a minute, you're getting all the good lines in there. This is something he'd suffered from before, you know. And, so, you know, but then he developed a sense of humor about it, and he said, well, it was just, we could have switched it around just to make it right, but it sounded better that way. I was better suited to that delivery.
You make a fascinating point in talking about that. You said that he was an artist who would not change a melody to accommodate a clever line. He wouldn't extend a line so that if you wrote a really great lyric, it would fit.
No, he was very, very precise. And I suppose that it's with that discipline comes, you know, the songs that he's written are not written over the incredibly unprecedented harmony. They're full of surprises. But they're very accessible. They're also pitched in the middle of the voice most of the time, so they're not like beyond them imagining that you can sing along with them and you can own them for yourself. So his writing, I learned a lot of things about, but not that I could replicate it, but his adherence to the melodic line, once it was established, was resolute, which is something he shares with Burt Bacharach, and they're two of the best melodists that we know, so maybe there is something to that. I mean, the Attractions and latterly the Masters would testify that my songs are very uneven in structure, and quite often three verses will not have the same form, which of course makes them incredibly difficult to memorize, because they're three things that seem almost the same, but they're not quite the same. They'll have one different chord, or a line will be slightly longer. And it's kind of uncommon to write like that, but that's probably driven by the fact that I'm a lyricist, primarily, and some sort of position after that, you know?
In a book that's filled with fascinating stories and anecdotes, your account of your time at the White House honoring Paul McCartney is one of the most purely joyful accounts, I think.
Shall I read a little bit of that?
Absolutely.
Okay.
We'll be taking your questions in a moment, by the way, in case you do.
Let me see. This was on the occasion when Paul, I have to, I have no idea what the damn chapter is called.
I think it starts with you having forgotten your guitar inside the White House.
Mm-hmm. Oh, forget about that. I'll just tell you the story.
It's a book on tape version.
There is actually a book on tape version. There is. It was like, took me eight days to record the 18 and a half hours, so I was speaking very fast. It was an occasion where Paul McCartney was receiving the Gershwin Prize for songwriting, and a group of us, Andrew House, Faith Hill, Jack White, the Jonas Brothers, all the hits of the day, were gathered at the White House, and you know, it's a very head-spinning thing to be at events like that, to play a gala in honor of somebody that you admire so much. And the distance between ourselves at the central microphone position was to the back of the hall was from about here to the edge of the stage. It was only four rows deep. Sitting here was Paul McCartney and his then fiancée Nancy. Sitting here was President Obama and Mrs. Obama and Mrs. Obama's mother and the Obama daughters and the rest of the people from the government and the people from the Library of Congress. So everywhere you looked, there was somebody who would scare you, you know. And one by one people, and at the end of the evening, after we had all performed these rather tentative, in some cases nervous versions of the songs, I came out into the hallway outside of the room, the east wing where we played, and Rahm Emanuel, his then chief of staff, he was down a little ways away from me, and he went. I thought, that's the kind of gesture that some senatorial defector would recognize as the end of his political career. And I was so shaken by this gesture that I said my goodbyes to the McCartney family and walked outside, and as the door went click outside the security gate, I went, I knew there was something I had with me. My guitar. And you know, on the way in, they're taken as the, because we were sort of, you know, the entertainment for the night, we didn't walk in with the dignitaries, we were taken into the kitchen, and the White House aide, who had his blazer on with a little badge on, he took us through and he helpfully pointed out to the English people coming in the scorched arches where the red coats had torched the White House. I sort of thought we should know that, so I thought it was probably a bad idea to go and knock on the door and ask for my guitar back with an English accent.
You had actually engaged somebody from the Marine Band to play the horn part on Penny Lane?
Yeah, but that was just magnificent. You know, my grandfather was a military-trained musician, so I have a great love for the trumpet. He was an orphan, you know. His father was killed in what we'd call now an industrial accident, and his brothers were sent 200 miles from home. And he must have shown an aptitude during his time in his orphanage for music, and it was his escape from that institutional life. Oddly enough, he ended up in another one, which was to be in the army at the age of 12. So I've always had a fondness for that instrument and for military playing generally. So I had chosen Penny Lane as the song that I would sing, and not just because it's one of the greatest songs ever written, but because my mother was from like about half a mile, quarter of a mile from Penny Lane. It felt like a personal song when, you know, it's a beautiful thing when something so imaginative as that comes out of a place that you can visualize in your head, and it's actually it's a very, very mundane street. That was the beauty of the song. It ennobled and made fantastic this place that you would drive by. If it wasn't for the tourists there now trying to unpeel the road sign, you know, you would drive by anyway. In fact, I don't think they've had a road sign there for years. You know.
I have your questions here. Let me give a few.
See, that was like a flourish, like in a magic show.
That's right. This is from Suzanne. I like to think everyone has a favorite artist whose music can bring them out of any bad mood. For me, that's you. Do you have an artist who can always lighten your day?
It's not the first thought I have when I go play music, really, lightening my day. Of course, there are some things that always lift you. I think that Aretha Franklin playing the piano, for instance, would be one thing. You know, just her playing the piano in production. You know, don't play that song. You know that piano part? It's like the introduction to a million gospel records, but if you ever see footage of her playing, she's a totally different singer behind the piano. I mean, it's the command of the whole thing is coming from her. So that, I would always think of that. Yeah, that would be a pretty good example.
A lot of your songs strike me as struggling with personal demons. This is from Matthew. Like 13 Steps Lead Down, my science fiction twin, Deep Dark Truthful Mirror, to name a few. Writing songs like these, is it to exercise your own personal experiences or as a cathartic release?
I didn't think of it like that. I was just writing down what came into my head. I mean, I think it was easier to see what they were about when I wrote about them now because of this book, really, frankly. I wasn't self-consciously helping myself. I was writing pop music. Deep Dark Filthy Mirror, I think, is quite a brutal song in many ways. And 13 Steps Lead Down is obviously a reference to One Step Further Than a Recovery Program. So, I mean, it has some reference to the desire to resist temptation. I never really thought of it in that way, if you'll pardon.
Judy asks, which album is your favorite or the one you are most proud of?
I could tell you something now and I'd tell you something else by the time we got to the car park. Or I could tell you I don't like any of them. I mean, it's the next one.
What are you doing to make sure, this is from Rosalind,
what are you doing after the show?
What are you doing after the show? I got five of those here, yeah. This is interesting though. What are you doing to make sure you're receiving your correct royalties? This is kind of a today's. In today's landscape, are you on Spotify? Rosemary says they pay the labels, not the artists. Thanks.
I just do whatever President Swift tells me to do. there's a good example of somebody who did, you know, stand up and say, like, that's a recent example of a very successful artist speaking up for her fellow artists who aren't so well fit. I see some young friends of mine who are trying to start now. I say it in the book that my career and our career in both the Attractions, the Impostors, and the other bands I've played with falls predominantly in the period after they bought your songs for $50 and the keys to a Cadillac, and before everything was supposed to be free. That doesn't mean that we made massive fortunes, because the way I ran my business was to put everything, more or less everything I earned, into making the next record or going on the next crazy tour where I had two bands on the road with me, and then I would leave them both in the hotel while I played a solo show. That's a good way of going broke. just doing the thing that, in other words, doing the thing that you were lucky enough to get to do, and doing it in style, or the style that you felt was right at that moment. So I didn't accrue so much security from just the working impulse to either be lazy or to just simply stop and coast. And I'm grateful for that. I mean, I'm sort of glad I didn't have more hits in a way, because then it would have been a matter of having to, motivate yourself. I had to work. I still have to work.
The lookbacks in this book seem fresh because you don't seem like someone who thinks in a nostalgic way. But you fell in love with America because of our record stores. You spent most of your time on your first run here going to old record stores, taking home all this music, and that world, that life, is essentially gone now. How does that make you feel?
Well, I mean, on the other hand, you could look at it the other way, that all of the music that I used to carry around in literally a suitcase, I would buy a cheap suitcase, take home all these secondhand records, which filled in the enormous amount of musical information between the one or two singles or compilation tracks through which I knew about, rhythm and blues, soul music, country. Suddenly you could buy whole albums by Stonewall Jackson, or Otis Clay, or the Louvin Brothers, all this great music that was right under everybody's noses and was just sitting there in the rack waiting to be discovered. Now I can carry that around in my pocket. It doesn't sound as good because it's crushed down into an MP3, but in terms of accessibility, I have, again, younger friends who are musicians who, they have far more knowledge of the catalogue through our history than I could have had. So theoretically, we should be in the best time in music because of people's knowledge of music. I think the danger is the ubiquity of certain trends in music wiping out those individual local accents, so which is why I suppose once in a while it's good to listen to records that come from a few years ago before everybody was listening to the same tune at the same time.
Do you have any substantial influence over your twins' musical taste?
They like the Immigrant Song off Led Zeppelin 3. and Donald Wears Your Trousers, which is a novelty song about kilt. Like 8-year-olds, they should oscillate between completely ridiculous songs. So obviously Donald Wears and Trees is their more serious mood, and the immigrant songs, the ridiculous songs about Vikings, you know. They will occasionally surprise you. We're driving along in the car and they'll say, "Can I hear that again?" And it'll be "My Ship" by Miles Davis. Now they don't need to know who Miles Davis is yet. They can, you know, when my wife and I were expecting them, we went to see a great double bill at Carnegie Hall. And the double bill was Kris Kristofferson and George Jones. And so, you know, I know both of those gentlemen a little bit, so I went back to see Chris after his set. He was on stage at the Carnegie Hall now with an acoustic guitar that he never had in tune once during the show. And all these incredible songs that just magically held this audience, just all on his own. So I went back and I didn't expect to see George, and I certainly would never presume to go into his dressing room. And his wife Nancy saw Diana and I and took us into him to say, you know, hello to him. And the minute George saw Diana expectantly, he asked the question that older people tend to ask, are you having boys or girls? And we've not been telling anybody. And we, you know, thinking, well, we may not see him for a little while, we let slip what we knew, and about 20 minutes into the show, like country artists, they like to make the audience feel like they really like to go their friends, you know. And he said, well, my very good friend, Elvis Costello, came back in, you know, this up in terms of Johnny Cash, everybody, but my very good friend, Elvis Costello, came back to see me before the show with his beautiful wife, Diana. She's expecting twins. Boys, I'm here. And I matched the sex of royal twins to Carnegie Hall. For a moment of terror there, we thought everybody would know, but of course nobody cared. And I think now, when I look ahead to the future, when my boys are old enough to go to the shelf and pull down a George Jones record and go, look at this guy's great haircut, and put it on and hopefully marvel at his voice as I have done, it'll be fantastic to tell them that tale. They were announced to the world by one of the great singers who ever lived. You know, that's not something that many fathers can give to their sons.
You busted out a nice little Johnny Cash there, and if I recall correctly, June Carter Cash told you she was kind of angry at her husband at one point.
Well, yeah, we were introduced to Johnny and June not when we went to Nashville to make the Almost Blue record, but when Nick Lowe married into the family. My producer became a Cash Carter Cash son-in-law. He married Carlene, June's daughter, and the in-laws are inclined to come around at Christmas, so it was a slightly bizarre experience to go around to Nick and Carlene's house at Christmas and find Johnny Cash in the front room, you know. It was just such an extraordinary thing, because he looked so much like himself. We got to record together, and then in Nick's home studio, it was a song that, you know, I sounded like a tiny little 7-year-old girl next to Carly Cash. Later, when we went to Nashville, they treated us like extended family, because we were Nick's friends, even though he was not involved in that record. They had us to the house. They treated us really kindly. We went along, I'd been on a 9-day drunk, you know, and I turned up at this grand house in Hendersonville on the lake, and they threw like a banquet with all this strange southern food, and Johnny took us around his house and showed us all his memorabilia, and there on a little stand was this Sun 45, and it happened to be the first song we'd recorded during the session, so really struggling for a response to the grandeur of the house and all this head-spinning experience. I said, oh, we cut that song, and he whipped the record off the stand, took out a pen and signed, "To Elvis, your friend, Johnny Cash," and gave me the record. I took it home and I put it in a frame, and about 6 months later, June came to visit again in London, and I went over to see her, and she said she was very vexed with Johnny Cash. We always referred to him by his full name. She said he gave away the first thing that he ever gave to me. Back, it turns out that back in 1955, I think, they'd been on the Louisiana hayride together long before they were a couple. And, you know, I suppose it seemed as something like June was like, really, she was like the clown of the Carter family, and Johnny would have come on and go, "Well, Miss June, I brought you love, some 45 record, this, a new song, some wrote a bit, was going, cry, cry, cry." David, the record is a sort of piece of theatrical business, and it was long forgotten among the mementos in the house. And now Johnny had given it to me, signed it, and I put it on in a frame on the wall. I couldn't give it back to her. You know, I'm sure they had millions of very precious artifacts, but it was, it's a nice memory of these people. You know?
We have time for two more questions. One of them is simply, and this is in the book, who is Allison?
It's whoever you want it to be. That's not an evasive answer, because you're seeing somebody in your head. I mean, I think I'm amazed and here is my very kind of tricksy way of getting you to buy the book. The answer is very clearly imprinted in the book. You just have to read it. It's not, it's, you know, it's, this is not detective fiction. It's also not confession. It is, I think, very clear, the identity, and I did speak very clearly about how I felt, as I said, the doubts I had about myself. So I don't think it really required me to write, "Allison was, of course." I don't think it actually illuminates the song. There were a few passages in this book which are rendered in fictional style because I just wanted to conjure up the room certain events happened in. The identities of the people were not important. It was the mood, it was the temperature of the room, the way it's described, the atmosphere.
There's a moment when you're speaking to Bob Dylan, when you're suggesting that you should sing Tears of Rage, is that right?
Well, I was on the road with Bob on a couple of occasions, which were always tremendous. I mean, he was gracious, and I opened for him in 1995. And then I did a longer tour with him, I think in 2008, I was on the Bob Dylan show. It sounded great because I really felt like a vaudevillian, you know, picture of Bob hopping out of a star on the poster. And Amos Lee opening up, and I played just with my acoustic in the middle. And after a few, couple of weeks maybe, I got a call from his stage manager. I was sort of just having a coffee or something backstage, and he said, "The boss wants to see you." And I went up there, and Bob's up on the stage tuning his guitar, and he said, "I've been thinking about ways how to get you into the act." You know, like that was guessed the way you saw it. You know, like, "I'm thinking about ways how to get you into the act." And he said, "How does that song, Peace, Love, and Understanding, go?" And of course, I was shocked because I figured he would suggest singing one of his songs, you know. And that's what I said. I said, I didn't really think that his audience would tolerate me coming up in the middle of his show and playing a song that I was known for, least of all because I didn't write it, you know. I said, "How can we do, why don't we do, like," I thought, "well, I won't say Blowing in the Wind or something obvious, or any more than, you know, I would have responded to somebody saying, 'Hey, play Allison,' you know, or even, 'Who is Allison?" So I suggested, I think it was Tough Mama, or some very obscure song. And we tried it, and it didn't sound very good, and then we tried Tears of Rage, and it did sound really good. Then he called the band up, and the band kind of got into it, and then it got a little bit kind of crazy, and it didn't sound so good. So I decided to leave it for a while, and I thought that was the end of it. And then one night, like 10 days later, he suddenly announced we were going to do it. And when I got to the side of the stage, it was just him and me. And I thought, okay, guess we can do this, and no band. And we walked out. And when the lights came up and there were just the two of us in the spotlight, the place went crazy. And I found out later that he had not sung without becoming a band for about 14 years. So people who look for secret signs and things that Bob Dylan does, you know, were remarkably, you know, noted this. And we began singing the song, or at least I began singing it, and he just didn't sing. I've been singing the song you know, back in Liverpool when I was 17, I loved this song. It's a song about fathers and sons, so it meant a lot to me at that time. I was a father, you know, new father in him. I'm singing it, and he came in the first chorus in harmony, and it's always an interesting proposition to sing with him, because whatever note you choose, he'll come and challenge you for possession of that note. and he sings with no, you know, quarter. I mean, it's a really, it's like being on a wild horse, you know. So I got to the second verse, and this time he came in on the last two lines of the verse, and I'm singing, and we get through the chorus again, and I get to the last verse. And I've learned, it's a very important thing that you can learn from bluegrass musicians and all the, you know, vaudevillians and obviously people like Bob Dylan who are, you know, you have to watch them. You can't look away. It is like a horse. You'll get thrown if you don't keep your eye right on what's happening. And as we began to sing the last verse, I knew from the look in his eyes he was going to sing. And I stepped back and he did sing. And it's a line that wasn't in the song. Leaving my next line not rhyming. And I figured, well, it's his song. He can change it if he wants to. You know, this is all going through my head in the split second before I have to resolve the rhyme. And I can't even, maybe it was a line from an earlier draft. Who knows? It's his song. He can change it if he wants to. And in the split second, I gathered. I somehow resolved the line, but I did it with a gesture in which I hit the guitar so hard, it made this huge clank, a bit like we were suffering earlier on. And he turned away laughing. Maybe that was the whole point of it. The strange thing was there were people in the front row, and I'm not insulting, but there were people in the front row who were fit to be tied, I've got to say. There were people doing strange interpretive dancing, and I kind of think I learned a little bit why somebody like that, who everybody reads into, you know, is maybe more cautious, and he sets up quite far back from the edge of the stage. So would I if I saw some of these people. Right back in the audience, everybody's just digging the concert, you know. There's some very strange behavior in the front row. So I sort of suppose I learned a little gesture, because it was, it's a working day. This is a man who does, you know, I don't know how many shows a year, but is constantly on the road. Not this bullshit about endless tour. It's an evolving thing. He's doing what he does. These beautiful songs are being animated every night in a drama, in the moment. And there's a lot to be learned from that, from anybody. You can't imitate it because he's got his songs and you've got yours if you write songs. But in that little moment of laughing, I thought, well, that's what makes anybody's working day worthwhile. A moment of humor. It wasn't actually about some mysterious significance. It was just about two guys up on the stage just singing a song and trying to get to work.
Final question here. You are responsible for my husband and I getting together. We now have an 8-year-old.
That was the end of the question.
We now have an 8-year-old. Will you pay for university, college, trade school music lessons? We're getting worried.
I'm puzzled to know why I'm responsible for this. And when it started, it sounded like the beginnings of a paternity suit. But I'm not quite sure. On what account? I mean, will I pay for it? No. It does remind me of a time when, you know, we had this show, The Spectacular Spinning Samba, which was debuted here it's just a piece of vaudeville equipment, you don't need to applaud that. And we revived it a few years ago, and we took it to, we were actually in Amsterdam, an English couple got up out of the audience and said it was their 25th wedding anniversary, and I said, well, spin the wheel, maybe something, and the song A Long Honeymoon came up. And for those of you who know it, this is not appropriate for the occasion. I said, maybe you want to try spinning it again, we don't want to curse the night, you know. They spun the wheel, Long Honeymoon came up. Give it another try, why don't you spin it one more time, you know. Long Honeymoon came up. So I've always been reluctant to sing at weddings ever since then.
Well, thank you for singing at ours. I think everybody here would like to thank you for decades of music and saving their lives.
I want to thank Chris so much. I want to hear a song before we go. We've got to have an appropriate image for the occasion. I think it's... you'll notice I have the same physique today. It'll just take us a moment to find a way. This is a picture I didn't get to show you, but I kind of like. This is a picture, I mentioned my dad before. That's a picture, my dad's along with Tom. And this was printed in the New Musical Express in 1977 when my secret identity was finally revealed. And they made the suggestion that that in fact was me, and I'd been lying about my age. And actually, I had another failed career in 1970, yeah. And I was actually 30, and I'd just got a haircut. Okay. Oh, what a lovely boy. I'll find something else for you here. It'll be more appropriate for the mood. It's an early version of the Blood and Chocolate picture. Thank you. thank Chris very much. I will apologize for the little acoustic problems we had earlier. I hope we didn't ruin the evening. Oh, it's an ill wind that blows no good. And it's a sad heart that won't love. But it's bad, even sad.